Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark podcast, the Fáilte Raibh Ó Ligh. I'm joined today by two trade union activists of the University and Colleges Union. In their spare time, they may also do a little bit of teaching and a spot of research. We have a regular on the podcast, Professor John Parry, and new for us today, Dr. Leone Hannon, both of the School of History, Anthropology, Philosophy and Politics. The links for the title of that department has its own story to tell, I'm sure, in what we're talking about today. You're both very welcome and thanks for giving up your time today. And today we're talking about the neoliberal university. You could probably pick any institution in society and talk about it, about its kind of neoliberal characteristics or how it's been shafted by neoliberalism. And today it's the turn of the university and the people who work in it. I know you've both been on a picket line, on strike again. Seems to be a regular occurrence now with the UCU. More power to your collective elbows. And so I really wanted just to kick off by asking you to tell us a little bit about the specific industrial background to the strike. What's actually under attack here? I'll go to you first, Leone, if you want to give us a bit of a background there.
Okay, so yeah, strike action of this phase started back in 2018, and we're now on the fourth sort of round of that. And it's focused, first of all, unusually, the flashpoint was really around pensions. Now, for anyone who's ever tried to think about a pension or look into it, it is obviously incredibly dull and incredibly complicated. So we were very unsure back in 2018 whether this would really be, you know, the thing that lights the fire under workers in our sector. But it was, because the sector as a whole had stagnating wages for a very long time, and workloads had gone through the roof. There were all sorts of worries about other issues, such as a lack of equality among staff, a lack of diversity in academic staff especially. And also things like rampant casualisation across the sector. So very, very many fewer decent jobs and very, very many more exploitative ones. So there was a whole range of issues, but pensions was the thing that lit the fire. And then since then, we've brought in the four fights, which covers those other issues. And so now we're fighting on all of these fronts. And I think really that was because on that first strike, when we were out over quite a precise issue, you might say, quite a technical one, people were like, no, the whole thing is wrong. Like, everything is connected, and this, that you can't just move something over here and fix this and make it okay. It's systemic. And so, yes, now it is quite a monumental fight we have on our hands.
Thanks for that, Leone. Yeah, I know what you mean about pensions. To younger people, it's hard to explain to them how important pensions are. But as soon as you hit my age and you get over that 5-0 mark, it looms large in your life, you know. And now I speak as someone without a fucking proper pension, but it is an important one. I'm not sure what the specifics of yours is. Are you moving from a defined benefit scheme to a defined contribution scheme, or you're already on a defined contribution scheme? What's the actual technical stuff? A lot of workers are interested in this stuff, of course, because any worker with a defined benefit scheme over the last 20 years has lost it. I mean, they're disappearing across. For those listening, that's like an end of final salary scheme. It's the one where you know what you're getting as your pension, as opposed to a defined contribution scheme, which is, you know how much you're contributing during your working life, but you've got no clue how much you're going to get if you ever have the joy of retirement. Which one is it in your case? Over to you, Leone, just carry on.
So when we initially went on strike back in 2018 about the pensions, this was a move. It was supposed to be a move towards defined contribution, losing defined benefit. We'd actually lost final salary some years before that, and there'd been a series of cuts to the pension, significant ones in previous years, that had caused less of a stir. Now, of course, we were told, as many workers are, oh, it's just a thing of the past, you can't expect this kind of thing anymore. That was a really common line sort of trotted out. On the other hand, another way of switching that around is to say, if we don't fight for this, no one's going to have it, because they will say the same thing to the next workforce, the next workforce, the next workforce. And also, what's to say you can't win in one area and also push for better pension rights in others? Obviously, there's been a huge pushback on decent pensions. And of course, the issue of casualisation has left many, many people, increasing numbers of people, without any sort of pension provision at all. It was one of our worries. We're relatively, parts of our workforce are quite privileged. Having a pension seems these days, in the neoliberal universe we live in, quite a privileged thing. That can be a hard sell when you're trying to justify strike action. Nonetheless, I think people understand what the situation they're facing and the fact that it is deferred pay. So this isn't just a sort of gift your employer gives you at the end of your working life. This is actually part of why you're working and what you're working for.
Yeah, exactly. But it is a big deal, though, isn't it? Because we used to say that all the time. I'm a trade union tutor. That's what I still teach trade unionists. And we always refer to pensions as this is your salary. You're just deferring it till you're retired. But that's changing now, isn't it? Because the burden of saving and investing, if you like, in a pension is moving from the employer to the individual person. John, what's your view of that?
No, that's exactly it. I mean, it's been a de-risking and an outsourcing, which is the kind of the logic of neoliberalism, onto workers to, you know, basically take care of themselves after they've retired. Whereas actually, as you said, pensions are deferred income. And part of the issue that, you know, Leonie and I are quite conscious of, for many people, university lecturers and so on are a cosseted, privileged set of workers, you know, kind of looks odd, I think, for a lot of people to see us out striking and so on. We're very polite, far too polite. We might get into that in terms of we need much more, in my view, robust strike action. But people have to remember that for people like Leonie and I, we didn't really start earning a secure salary until sometimes your 30s, because you spend quite a lot of time in PhD, master's training. Then there's usually maybe postdoc, insecure work. And then if you're lucky enough, you can get a job. So The earning age for many university academics is much later than what people think. But it is the case that for a lot of younger academics, they're now facing precarious work contracts. I mean, Leonie and I would both know, we're not going to name names, but there are colleagues that we would know that are mentally unwell. Their well-being has been massively impacted because they've been on these rolling fixed-term contracts. One person I know, 13 years since they graduated with their PhD, and they've still been on these rolling contracts. How can you if you want to buy a house or make plans and so on, you can't. And so that's the casualization. And it's particularly high at Queen's in terms of, I have to say, I was ashamed that I didn't know the amount of casualized staff and the proportion of teaching done at Queen's was, I think Leonie was at 50, 60% or something. That was, absolutely huge. And yet we have, I'll just finish by saying we have, on the one hand, the report that's just come out recently, or that Queen's University earned £50 million from international student fees. We have students paying £17,000 a year for postgraduate courses, and they're being taught by casualised staff who are given and paid to maybe spend 20 minutes to mark their essay. So they're getting a shoddy service with stressed out, precariously employed staff. And yet they're paying an awful lot amount of money in terms of this, stressed environment, and, which can't lead to good quality education. That's the point, is that our working conditions are the students' learning conditions. So that's why it is about trying to fix and kick back against what effectively now is a broken system.
Yeah, I want to get back to that one later on, because precariousness is something that's really important to talk about, I think, in this regard. I know it's one of the big issues for the union as well. But these kind of attacks, and I'm sure that senior management's defined benefit schemes are still extant, by the way, but we'll maybe go there later on, in terms of we can't afford these things. What we mean is we can't afford them for you scumbags, but we can afford them for senior management. They're perfectly okay, But these, as I said, these attacks are part of a wider shift, aren't they? And a fundamental shift, really, in the role that universities are seen to play in society. Most of us, and me included, have a vague, perhaps kind of romantic notion of universities, of sites of learning and kind of progress and enlightenment. But increasingly, they seem to be being forced to play a role in a market, to regard each other as competitors and, to work in a marketplace, and as students and our consumers or clients or whatever, and ideas are for sale. What was your understanding when you first came into universities and thought, I would like to do that, I would like to teach, I would like to research? And what is it now? So when you started your journey, Leonie, did you know what you were going into, or did you too have that slightly romantic notion about being a researcher and being involved in ideas and teaching people and seeing light bulbs appear above people's heads when you were talking to them? And what's your view of that university now?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, and I think, to be honest, it may well be romantic given the brutal realities of the situation. But actually, I think that's exactly the view that almost every academic or aspiring academic still holds, regardless. And it is the thing that motivates. And it is amazing how much people will do for that little glimmer of something that they're engaged with. So if they get to do that sometimes, they will plough through a lot of other stuff to get there. I'm a lucky one, but I was only really made permanent when I was almost 40. I was on precarious contracts before then. I was also the first year of student fees when they came in the late 90s. And so I had debt from that, which I only paid off in my mid-30s. And I'm the beginning of that wedge that's just grown and grown and grown. And so people, you know, and I was coming through in that way. It was very difficult in terms of, I actually had like a 6-month-old baby, but I think when they confirmed me in post, and I was, you know, desperate to be confirmed in post at that point. But I'm the lucky one. Anyone coming through after that has greater debt, more precarity, and you know, and greater challenges. So yes, the reality of living in a very working and living in this neoliberal environment is very, very undermining of the core things that motivate you and that motivate students and that we would regard as having like real value. Instead, you're corporatized, you're marketized, you're trained to think of yourself as a content provider for consumers who have satisfaction or lack of it. And you're constantly sort of gaslit, saying that we have all sorts of health and well-being. It all comes first. You come first, except you come absolutely last when it comes to any demand that you may have. The improvement of your, well, no, not even the improvement of your working conditions, but actually the maintenance of some kind of conditions. So, yeah, I would say this maps out to loads of workplaces. I can't see it being very different in lots of different spaces.
It's funny, isn't it, though, how universities are catching up with everywhere else. And you just said about being gaslit by being offered, you know, it's like well-being sessions, or it's like a yoga session at the end of your 12-hour shift at an Amazon warehouse, you know. Yeah. That's something to account for the fact that you've on a 0 hours contract on shit pay and no pension. John, what about you? You've been around a bit longer than Leonie, if you don't mind me saying. So your journey's slightly longer. So you may have seen more changes from when you first came into that idea of coming into a post-enlightenment institution, the site of learning, to what it is now, like a factory.
No, it is. I mean, I've been in the academic profession now for over almost 35 years, and I've seen tremendous change.
Are you including your leave insert in that? You're not that.
No,
sure,
no. I'm a lot older than you think. I mean, that's one of the benefits maybe of the academic world is that we do tend to age a little bit, you know, better than other forms of work. And in fact, that's an interesting element, is that there's a curious feature about the academic lecturer, is that on the one hand, we're the most self-exploiting workforce in the world. I mean, it's exactly as Leonie said, many of us are, in the best possible terms, geeks. We just love what it is that we're doing. We're passionate about particularly research interests, and many of us are also then passionate about learning. And it's a great privilege to have the opportunity to share ideas and to, you know, teach students and engage with them and so on. But on the other hand, it is also means that I think we accept quite a lot of pain for that little bit, what Leonie mentioned there, the bit of the good stuff where you can do your research, maybe get a day a month where you're just not dealing with emails or all the other bureaucratic crap that we have to do, and you can just deep dive into your particular research area. And it is, particularly for somebody like me, and I am in a privileged position, I'm a professor, I've got economic security, and so I have quite a lot of autonomy. So there is autonomy in the job. So it's not all negative, but it's all, in a way, you have to pay so much to get that element of what I thought I was entering into the profession over 30 years ago, which was a place of collegiality, a place where we could have a decommodified, you know, non-monetary exchange related discussion, production of ideas, particularly about challenging and opening students' minds up to the world that's around them, to create and cultivate within students a sense of citizenship, to arm them with knowledge and, you know, and therefore with some degree of power over their own lives. These are the motivations, certainly, for those of us in the social sciences, arts and humanities. Now, there is a distinction often when you go over to engineering and health, and that's part of a problem with the way in which the modern university is set up. But certainly I remember a time in my first job at Keele University back in the 1990s, we elected our own heads of school. You know, there was that sense that, we had democracy, we had autonomy as scholars. And the last thing I'd say is that we were trusted. You know, our judgment was trusted as scholars, as professionals. Whereas now, and I'm sure Leonie, and I know Stevie, you have experience of the university system, there's so much bureaucracy now that is second guessing and questioning our professional judgment. So it's not just the precarity, the stagnating wages, and the casualization and so on. But on top of that, then, what I'd experienced in my early career as a lot of autonomy, a lot of collegiality, a lot of sense of being valued and having a sense of collective judgment about electing a head of school or curriculum development and so on. There's still elements of that there, but there's so few now from what I remember. That just shows you how degraded and debauched in some ways the neoliberal, you know, way in which knowledge now is seen as a commodity, that our job effectively
I do want to get onto that, John. I do want to get onto that because the commodification of knowledge is central to this whole neoliberalization of universities and stuff. And it's funny you talked about the before about precarity. It keeps coming up as a word you both keep using all the time. I wanted you to just give another chance to talk about that, because if you'd have told someone 10 years ago, mom, if you'd have gone to your mum and says, mum, I've got a job in university teaching or researching, she'd have been fucking, oh, well done. Well, oh, that's marvelous. Because she'd have assumed that was a fantastic job that set you up for life. Whereas now, if you come home and tell someone you've got a job in university, they say, oh, really? Oh, never mind. You'll get something better done. Because it's not seen anymore as that kind of privileged position anymore, because precariousness has found its way into the institution itself, as precariousness has found its way into all institutions and all walks of life. And I read a bit of UCU research recently there that said, I think it was something along the lines of 50% or more of all academic staff are on insecure contracts. I couldn't quite believe it was as high as that. I know. In work that I've done in my own union in Unite down in Limerick University, we have hundreds of members down there, and most of the lecturers down there are on fixed term contracts. There's hardly any full time workers there. Leone, how bad is it, and why does it matter?
It's really bad. So the other thing that can seem quite strange about the system is that very elite institutions such as Cambridge or Edinburgh University have some of the highest rates of casualised workforce. So I think it's something like 70-odd% of all academic staff in Cambridge University and Edinburgh University. They were two of the highest at least a couple of years ago. And at Queen's, we're around 60-odd%. Now, if you could look to lots of institutions in the US and find extremely high levels of precarity too. There's no sort of natural stopping point with this. This can always get worse. And I think that's what workers really, really need to know. The other side of it is of course, when the people who brought in fees for tertiary education had an idea in mind. They didn't just think, oh, we'll take a few quid and then leave everything else the same. They had an idea that they would create a marketplace out of HE and that institutions would rise and fall. Specifically, elite institutions would be able to gather as much resources as possible and obviously feed that primarily to the students from the wealthiest backgrounds, with perhaps a few token scholarship kids from more deprived background. So this is the notion. And then other institutions, especially lots of the post-92 institutions that would have been polytechnics, could happily go by the wayside as they served many, many, many more working class people. And I think this is still the notion. And of course, it didn't really come to pass because the funding cuts were so severe to universities, especially arts universities, that every university charged whatever the maximum fee was every time it went up. And in England, obviously, it's gone up and up. A bit different in Northern Ireland and Scotland there. So, but this marketplace idea still holds when you think about casualisation and also about pensions. So with casualised, if you can casualise the workforce, it's very, very much easier to let large chunks of it go, right? You have no responsibility long-term to those people. So the more and more you casualise, the easier that marketplace idea of HE is, higher education is. Also, if you can divest yourself of responsibility for pensions, of the need to pay people those pensions in the long term, the more you can do that, again, if your institution goes under, the less liability that you have, okay? And at the moment, you know, we were talking about the defined benefit to defined contribution move, which we've held firm on, but the latest round of suggestions from the pension and employers is that we have a two-tier system where people coming in who can't afford really high contributions will just be on a much crapper pension. And you can imagine how an increasing number of people will be on the crapper one, and a very few people, and it'll be generational, will be on the better version, and then slowly but surely you degrade the whole. So yes. So sometimes I feel like the pension thing mirrors neoliberalism in the sense that it feels like the people in charge of that pension are driving that pension off a cliff in the sort for short-term gain, a bit like in the financial crash. But if you say it's not just the madness of their kind of greed in the current moment, there is a sort of larger and perhaps you could say more, you know, makes more sense to say that they are trying to create a situation where institutions can fail and the marketplace. The market is king.
Yeah, unions have to be very careful of that. We've shot ourselves in both feet over the years with this red circling of privileged kind of contracts and privileged pensions, or not, I shouldn't say privileged, that's not fair, decent pensions and decent terms and conditions. And we've red circled staff, letting other staff come in. And over the years, and I've seen it happen in so many different places over the last 20 years, and then you get this hierarchical unions where you have kind of workers on good terms and conditions, good pensions, and other workers coming in, as you said, totally casualized. Trying to organize that is tough, because the ones on the shit contracts go, why would I pay the same fucking contributions as the ones who've got defined contributions or defined benefit pension scheme? I want to move on a little bit here, because we're getting onto the core nub of this, which is about the marketization of learning and the commodification of knowledge, because that's really what this is about. And also, why are they doing that? Well, the next question is because it's about extraction of wealth. And it's about summing, it's about someone making money somewhere in this context. So in 2010, John, the Tories kind of all but removed public funding from universities, and they made universities rely broadly on higher student fees and, of course, any other monies they could pull in from the private sector involvement. And now that's central to all universities, isn't it? Is partnerships with the private sector. And that, of course, drives a competitive university market. And that's had a massive impact on the political economy of research itself and research funding. I mean, research is central to being an academic alongside your teaching. The question is what research is getting funded and what research isn't getting funded and how those decisions are made. Does everything, in your opinion, in your experience, increasingly have to have a market value? Is there a pressure to make sure that your research can somehow be sold somewhere or have a market value further down the line? Over to you first.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is the political economy of higher education now has led to universities becoming businesses. You know, you can take it in terms of research, and a lot of our funding comes from Research Council funding. And just look at the amount of money that is going into what you might call system maintaining extractivist forms of wealth or energy research. And how little, for example, the areas of knowledge production and dissemination that Leonie and I would represent on the arts, humanities and social sciences, even though we carry the heaviest burden on the teaching side, in terms of the research income, say, for a university like Queen's, that's going to largely come in from, you know, engineering, from public health and so on. And that's where you find, you know, follow the money. You know, what research is being funded? We are not getting the funding for critical Marxist studies of late neoliberalism, for example, to the extent that I could do that PhD, John.
I would knock that out of you, no bother.
Myself and Leonie would gladly co-supervise you on that. I mean, don't get me wrong, that's still being done. But the amount of money that you see going towards those more critical, what I would say is the heart of the university is that it's a place of critical reflection in terms of enabling students and staff to look ahead and horizon scan where society is going. Look today, what's going on in the structure of our economy, globalization, the climate crisis. That's the job of the university. I mean, that's how I see the public or civic purpose of the university is that's what society should be expecting of us. And that's, and there's still an element of there that, don't get me wrong, but mostly universities are now there to maintain the capitalist system, to maintain the market. You know, we see a lot more effort, for example, in the internationalization agenda, which we already mentioned, Queen's handsomely, you know, coined in 50 million from international students. They are mostly not coming to be taught by Leonie and I in terms of critical social science and humanities. They're doing things like management. They don't do economics anymore, of course. Economics is now, you know, a busted flush. In the university's worldview, the economic debate is over. Capitalism won, and all we do now is management. Or they're doing engineering. You know, we very rarely see, for example, Asian students, and we get a lot of Asian students from mainland China and elsewhere. They aren't coming to study with me low carbon energy transitions from a political economy perspective. They're doing things like management. They're not doing law. They're not doing human rights and so on. The university is actively, in other words, reproducing a system maintaining, you know, form of knowledge production. So whether it's in teaching, even within our modules, Stevie, a lot of people might find this really bizarre. We have to formally include entrepreneurship skills, you know, in terms of our teaching. So we are reproducing, you know, to use an old Louis Althusser term, we're kind of like now ideological state apparatuses to reproduce a pro-capitalist, pro-system maintaining view in which we're actively encouraging students to become entrepreneurs. I mean, the university, our university, and I'm sure it's no different than other places, has extracurricular activities for students to go and do entrepreneurship. When I went to the people who do this in the university, I said, well, what about worker cooperatives? What about maybe even social enterprises? They just looked at me as if I got two heads. You know, so we're actively and explicitly now creating, you know, citizens that are going to be either docile and knowledgeable workers or to become brave entrepreneurs. And we encourage this kind of sharp elbows, individualized experience, even though, again, many of us picking on the arts, humanities and social science, and indeed some colleagues in elsewhere in the university, it's unfair to, you know, pit academic disciplines against each other. Some of us are aware of it. But for many colleagues, it is simply that's how they see the system. You know, we're here in a way to be an adjunct to the market. We are either to create, in the infamous words of a former vice chancellor of our own university, you know, oven ready graduates that can be simply popped into maybe the public sector, to be state managers, into the private sector and so on. That idea of the university as an incubator of critical citizen knowledge, it's not gone completely, don't get me wrong, but it is so much more a paler imitation of what I think society deserves from universities.
Yeah, thanks for that, Leonie. It's amazing, isn't it? It's not just the institution itself that's been forced to compete in a market, but the ideological nature of what's being taught and what's being researched is also kind of, as John showed, under attack as well. There's the idea, and I remember my partner teaches in the tech, teaches maths, and they have to teach modules on entrepreneurialism. So it's not just in universities, it's all the way up from they go to primary school, because there are changes to the curricula across primary schools and secondary schools as well, where they have to teach entrepreneurial skills as well. But how does it affect research? Have you seen it happen in terms of what's available in terms of research? You have to kind of almost prove there's some sort of market value at the very end, at least. You have to prove there's some sort of reason why you should do this research because it's good for the system.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult for me because I do sort of 18th century history. So there's very little market value that can be squeezed out of that one. But no, that's definitely a feature of the system now. I would say just on the sort of science, technology, engineering and medicine side of things, is actually they're one of the more, you know, biological sciences. We often look a bit jealously at them because there's more money and there's more grants and stuff. But actually, they're one of the most casualized sort of workforces. Very, very few people are secure there. And the hierarchical system then, someone's career future, if they even have a career in biological science, it really depends on the boss. You can't publish independently very easily in a lab until you have your own lab. And in biological sciences, if you're looking into different kinds of diseases, cancer gets huge amounts of money, is funded in particular ways. But take a sort of disease like malaria that massively affects the global south, and you know many, many people's lives. Very little money available. So it's very, very, it's really clear cut in those science disciplines as well, I think. But yeah, no, definitely, definitely that emphasis is there. And there's a boldness as well. I sit on a governing body of the university, sort of astonishingly. In that, you can have with one moment talking about widening participation and the fact that 32% of Queen's students come from low-income backgrounds, which is a very high number, and how they have to work three jobs, and therefore we need philanthropy to provide various studentships for them. With the other part of that meeting, they can be saying, you know, the various members who sit on that body who are from outside the university, people who are leaders in business and accountants and so on, can be saying we're not meeting business needs and business should be able to dictate what goes on our curriculum. And then you can also have the same meeting, and this literally happened yesterday, where they decide, having discussed how students can't, from poor backgrounds, can't afford this education, they can then put up the fees for the housing that's available on campus, saying it's just terrible they haven't been able to put it up for 2 years when no wage has gone up and no student loan has gone up. And even if it had gone up, that was a burden that's obviously then carried for a lifetime. So that is the sort of madness of the situation. Extremely corporate. The people we invite in onto these governing bodies to give us an external perspective are not drawn widely from the community, from different sectors, from working class communities. They're drawn from a very narrow section of population who are people who have wealthy people and people who are politically powerful and powerful in business.
Yeah, it's shocking when you hear it from the inside, because way back in the 80s, when Thatcher talked about there is no alternative, we've seen that dictatorship of no alternatives has colonized every institution in society, to the point that you can't act or think outside, including in universities. And that rolls over too into, I suppose, the something you mentioned earlier on, John, which is about the commodification of knowledge itself. And you have academic research that you produce with public funding, but held beyond paywalls of powerful, and it seems fairly profitable academic journals. I know you wanted to come in on that one, John.
No, again, it's another example, in a way, of the exploitative, extractive nature of knowledge production. You know, in a way, why would we expect it to be any different than the extraction of wealth or resources that we see as the modus operandi of, you know, extractivist neoliberalism? So we produce knowledge largely based on publicly funded, you know, there is some private sector, you know, again, largely on in other disciplines than the ones that myself and Leone would operate in. But we produce this publicly funded knowledge. And then, I mean, I first really saw this in operation here in Northern Ireland, where I seen PricewaterhouseCoopers, who had done a report. And a lot of it was based upon them simply, you know, using in a fairly, in my view, I would have given them maybe a 2-2 for the quality of their work. They simply cut and pasted in a descriptive way, already produced publicly, you know, funded knowledge. And then they charge God knows how many thousands of pounds to the government department. That's a massive issue that might make an interesting part in the future, Stevie, is in terms of the amount of money, millions of pounds every year, the Northern Ireland Assembly and ancillary government agencies here spend on private KPMG, PwC. They tend not, actually not often to go to university for some of the more, I suppose, maybe critical work that needs to be done. But we produce this publicly, you know, funded knowledge. It's then creamed off by private sector actors such as that. But you as a citizen, and of course, we won't get into the MMT issue, but, you know, people think that, you know, taxpayers pay for, you know, our public services, which of course they don't, but we leave that to one side.
Your taxes pay for fuck all, say it loud, yeah. John. Your taxes pay for fuck all.
So folks, you can take it here from a professor and two doctors here on this call that your taxes do not pay for anything. They have other functions in terms of creating a less unequal society. But that idea that we produce in a peer-reviewed academic journal that's often then inaccessible to a member of the public unless you've got the money for a subscription for that journal, or even more insidious, we now have to build into our research proposals a pot of money so that when we do produce peer-reviewed articles, that we can then pay for them to be made open access or some other, you know, there's different, you know, grades. So we are literally turning, you know, publicly produced knowledge into, you know, parceled up, privately accessible forms of commodities. And much of this knowledge, I think, you know, should be freely available. I'm always of the view, knowledge is like manure. It should be spread around. It's no good unless you spread it around. You know, it has to be disseminated. And we already do this, or those finish in the sense that we have this contradiction that on the one hand, we produce our knowledge that's disseminated amongst our peers. And the peer review process, for those of you listening, it can be a brutal process. It can be very, very useful, where essentially our ideas are, you know, stress tested, challenged, sometimes ripped apart. And it's quite a personalized experience when you get back some really bad, you know, negative comments. But it's good in a way that it means whatever is produced, you've socialized it amongst your peers, you've discussed it. But then all that goes into, you know, a journal that's there to make money. And they essentially, you could just go on to some of the big journals in my area, and you got to pay maybe $100, because a lot of them are based in America, to get access to a, you know, 15-page piece of work and so on, which is why the last thing to say, many of us are subverting this. We're probably acting illegally, but I don't give a shite. It's my knowledge. I produced it. Is that we would use open source platforms like academia.edu or ResearchGate. So anybody listening who wants to get certainly at least all my published works, whether it's behind a paywall or not, I've stuck it up there because that is what I think is the public service, the civic duty of academics is to create knowledge for society and then give it to society to do with what they want. That's our job.
Cheers for that, John. Look, we're going to move on a bit here. I don't want to take up all our time talking about the commodification of knowledge we could do. I wanted to also talk about management, if I can, and perhaps management remuneration. I know it's always dangerous when you're trying to identify pantomime villains in these scenarios, but I mean, there is a class of management now that emerges in all of these institutions. And I know, obviously, that academic salaries, as you said, haven't really, like most workers, haven't risen in line with inflation over the last few years. Whereas, for example, vice chancellors have had a fucking whopping 227% increase in their financial benefits, which is more than just their salary, also their defined benefit pension schemes, very handsomely paid in those. And the average pay is something like £250,000 a year. I mean, that's, I was working out, that's nearly £4,000 a week I mean, fuck, I wouldn't know what to do with $4,000 a week. I would spend it. Like, I think I'd have a good time spending it. But the idea that someone can be on $4,000 a week and it's perfectly normal in an education institution society, there's something wrong there. And of course, once you're on that kind of money too, and this never gets spoken about, it starts to allow you to have portfolios. You start to invest, you start to buy property. So their wealth, their capital only accumulates after that. So it removes them from the kind of class basis that we're on and into a different one. So neoliberal capital needs a compliant managerial class at best, particularly in these large institutions. At best, it needs an enthusiastic enforcer, doesn't it, of marketization, someone who's going to be kind of an evangelist for marketization. Do you see that, Leonie? Does that, without mentioning any names, of course, do you see that? Do you see that managerial class? Do you interact with it, and what are they like?
Yeah, I'd actually have to interact with it. So, I mean, it's a matter of public knowledge that our vice chancellor is paid £305,000 a year. And that, obviously, he's had a pay rise since he's been in that position. It's much more than the previous vice chancellor. It's always much more each time. There are lots of other perks that go to the job with the job, including pension stuff. And when you see the report from the remuneration committee, which sets those very high level salaries, you see, because they have to make the calculation, that it's 8.8 times the average salary across the university. But there's a little asterisk after 8.8, and it says not including anyone on a non-permanent standard contract. So that's not including any of your casualised workforce who are clearly on very low wages. So when you, that really begins to make the picture. So yeah, there is a managerial class. They're extremely well paid. This governing body I feel I sit on, I often see then how these extremely wealthy people from within the university and from outside of the university are obviously a milieu, aren't they? And it's very easy for a staff rep to feel very much on the outside of that. And I'm happy to be so. But yeah, it's that sheer wealth is just definitely problematic. I also think in terms of tactics for workers, it means you're never going to persuade them of anything. So I have spent a lot of my time trying to persuade senior managers of all sorts of things, mainly unsuccessfully. The only way we can persuade them is by pushing them to a point where the alternative is, you know, they can't consider, and then they will budge. So you're never going to sit in polite meetings in polite rooms and make changes that are good for workers. That you will tire yourself in that process, and I've spent a lot of time doing it, so I know. The only thing that makes a difference is if we can make any shift in the power relationship, and one of the few tools we have is industrial action and other forms of action of that nature. And it has to be direct and it has to be robust. It has to change the power dynamic to such an extent they all begin to consider a proposal that you have. And we're in a position now where we're really trying to hold on to things we used to have. We rarely ask for things that would make that would be, you know, progressive. I mean, God forbid anything radical. We're often trying to hold the line. A lot of workers struggles are like that, and it's difficult when you're trying to hold the line. You almost always in a negotiation lose a little bit. So I think increasingly we must think as trade unionists and workers very much about how we can what we have at our disposal to increase our power in that arrangement, and to spend a bit less time having polite conversations in committee rooms.
Yeah, John, we're not, if we cut through that to HR bullshit, we're not all part of the same team, are we? We're Labour, and this managerial class in these institutions represents, if they're not in the capitalist class, they certainly represent and shill for them.
No, absolutely. And some of them are quite gleefully anti-union. I mean, this is the real saddening thing for me in terms of casting my back maybe a little bit romantically than when I started in the profession. But to see, in inverted commas, colleagues, as they progress up the university management system, they absolutely become company people. And some of them become actually quite nasty. And in a way, you can criticise that, as we should. But then part of me feels sorry for them. That's the only way they can survive in that kind of cutthroat kind of managerial world, where they are now looking, you know, they have bought into the notion of the university as a business. But part of the problem, and again, you know, Leonie would know this, and she would probably share the similar view, we're far too fucking polite in the academy. We have a big banner, which I'm very proud of, that UCU has, which says we are the university. But I actually think a lot of colleagues don't really understand what that means. But that means that we should be a lot more assertive in using our professional judgment, to go back to what I said earlier. But I think a lot of colleagues feel very individualized. It is, as Leonie said, it's difficult to try and be progressive and move things forward when you're fighting constantly this rear guard action. And many of us get exhausted or, you know, get extremely cynical and, you know, get burnt out. And there are good colleagues that have, you know, for no fault of their own, they've just tried their best and they've just banging their head against the brick wall and can be quite demotivating. I can certainly think at certainly Queen's University Belfast, the union has had a transformational Damascan phoenix-like change in the last couple of years. It's much more, you know, robust. It's much more coordinated and organized. And I have to say, you know, even a small thing, and again, you know, people say, oh, look at them going on. We have no common room at the university. When I joined Queen's 20 odd years ago, there was a place you could go and you could have a cup of coffee. You can meet a colleague from a different school.
You had, have a chat. You had your own bar as well, by the way.
We had our own bar. We had a place. We had a place where workers could casually interact, is the point I'm getting at. I'm not saying we'd all be in there conspiratorially, you know, talking about Lenin's, what is to be done and how can we use this in terms of, you know, mobilizing against management, you know, mostly around their own academic work. But that sense of solidarity has been undermined by the you know, there are individualized work, precarious work, setting up this division between administrative staff and even within grades of academic staff. And for me, one of my best experiences of being at Queen's University for 20 odd years has been on the picket line in the freezing fucking cold, you know, acting the aegis, trying to get cars to, you know, beep. That's my job on the picket line. I have a Stakovanite, you know, I've got to reach a target every day of 200. I get extra if it's a PSNI and even more if it's a couple of taxis as well in a row. But on the picket line for me has been my experience of solidarity as an academic. I don't get that, as Leone said, in the administrative meetings that many of us go to, certainly not with management. And I do think it is, though, about seeing how can we have a create the space and the time, because that's the other issue. We're all very hard pressed with time, and union organizing, solidarity building does take time. And that's why I enthusiastically, without even knowing what the issue is, strike action. Yeah, I love some of that, partly because it's a break. Many of us, you know, bizarrely experience the strike action as a little bit of a holiday, and that we're away from all the usual demands on our time. But it's also been wonderful to be able to connect with colleagues and see we're not suffering alone. That's the issue. The university is now being created in such a way is that it's the classic divide and rule, that people are experiencing the same working conditions, the same shitty managerial bullying, but because they're on their own, they basically become more resilient in that crap neoliberal sense. But actually coming out on strike, you begin to share your stories, and from that, then you can build solidarity. So I'm looking forward to more strike action in the new year, I have to say.
No, as someone, as you know, who's been involved in political education for the last 20 years, particularly within the trade union movement, we often get asked by senior trade unions, so, you know, you want to do some political education, some political economy with our members, that's great. When do you want to do it? And our answer is always the same, immediately after you've had a strike, because the learning you have on a picket line is opens people up to listening to new ideas and new ways of learning and understanding power and power dynamics. And you understand power when you're on a picket line. And, you know, and you also understand the working class solidarity as well. And you're right. I mean, part of the neoliberal model, isn't it? Is to atomize society, is to break those bonds of community and solidarity. I mean, it's one of Thatcher's great successes, isn't it? There's no such thing as society and all that. And she was successful in that regard, in the sense that working class institutions don't exist anymore. I remember a good friend of ours who was doing a podcast with us recently on working class education said in the 1930s, there were 300 miners' libraries in Wales. I mean, even the very fucking thought of there being one miners' library in any trade union building would be a shock to me, but 300 miners' libraries. And that entire infrastructure of working class education and solidarity is what has been absolutely ripped asunder. And you're right, those spaces for workers to come together and talk and express themselves and see themselves as the same is really important, actually. And militant strike action is one of the ways you do that. Look, I want to move on because we are going to run out of time, and I think we'll have to come back and do another one on this actually in the new year, because there's loads of questions I'm not going to get a chance to ask you both. I know there's a huge debate about student fees, and we've briefly touched on the fact that the student fees model is now the funding model for universities. We know that UK students particularly are in massive debt. They're thinking of introducing a system, of course, into the Republic of Ireland. There was a paper out a couple of years ago to do the same. And I was reading the other day that students in Britain and the north of Ireland owe something like £9 billion in interest alone on the capital debts they owe. And we know the impact of that. We know the impact on that in terms of the choices young people are making and what they want to study particularly. And that's part of that neoliberalization, because you're forcing people into taking courses where they know they can get a job at the end of it, the poor bastards, because that's what their focus is from like the age of about nine now. But the other picture that's emerged quite recently, actually, in the past couple of years, and I just want your opinion on this, is PBSAs, purpose-built student accommodation. It's gone from kind of not being part of the picture, as far as I was concerned anyway, to being like central to the university funding model. And it's also one of the most lucrative parts of the entire property market in Britain now. Something like 45 billion last year was extracted. And that's the word to use, I suppose. I mean, is that all that matters now? Is that what we've been reduced to? I mean, are universities and what you do for a living just ancillary to wealth extraction? I'll come to you first, Leone.
Yes, I mean, it's definitely a part of the piece. I mean, the discussion I sat through yesterday was very inflected by that, effectively a landlord class, saying it's inevitable and absolutely morally justifiable to increase the cost of student accommodation owned by the university, not privately owned, you know, more or less every year, regardless of what their income looks like, or debt for that matter looks like, because obviously student income is often in the form of debt. So it's really, really attractive. And one of the things that the assets universities have is land and buildings, and some of the kind of big spending of the money that comes in, that floods into these universities, has been around buildings and especially these sorts of student accommodations. Now, you know, again, we don't have to delve that far back in time to remember when there was subsidised student accommodation that was affordable to people on grants or very, very low incomes. At the same time, you would have found subsidised canteens run by the institution on site, staff, students. These things really are a thing of the past. You've seen Costa coffees, expensive outlets, which don't pay any attention to the actual student body and whether or not this is appropriate. But, I mean, it strikes me that there are connections here, and obviously the dynamics are different. But, you know, I think it was an explicit step taken by people who were interested in privatising the NHS, that instead of having NHS kind of canteens, you would start to replace those with outlets that are, you know, big name private outlets. And that would be a way of literally sort of immerse people as they come through hospitals, get used to seeing things that are for sale in there.
Yeah.
And slowly but surely, this eases the way for you to fully privatize health. And I think, you know, universities are very privatized now in many, many respects, although they still take in lots of public money, and we shouldn't forget that. But yeah, similar strategies at work. And yeah, they can make huge amounts of money out of housing. As we know, it's one of the greatest ways that neoliberal society moves money from the working class to the very, very wealthy. It's exactly that way. And universities are no exception in doing that.
Yeah, housing is it is the vehicle, isn't it, for that massive transfer of wealth we've seen over the last 30 and 40 years, and particularly land prices, of course, which underpin the price of the building above it. I remember being heavily involved. I was on the Queen's Union Club Bar back in the day. I'm talking 30 years ago. And the Queen's Union Club Bar was an independent student association. We ran the bars and the students' unions at Queen's, and the profits we made, or the surplus we made, because it was an association, went to subsidise the student creche at Queen's. That idea now I think we gave it 70 grand a year at that time to subsidise, you know, so that people could come to university and have their kids looked after. That idea now is complete anathema to the way the university is run. And you're right, I'm glad you mentioned it. There's a hegemony, because when hegemony works best, it works because everything just looks normal. So it's perfectly normal to have Costa coffee in the student union. It's perfectly normal to have Guinness running the bars or whatever. And that's part of the marketization. There's no way in that system you can look where someone's not making money out of students, and those students aren't borrowing money to pay for that. And of course, they're borrowing money off people who are making money off the debt itself. So it's completely circled. You've no way out of that to exist anywhere else. John, any comments to make on the student accommodation thing? Because it has become a real fucking, I mean, it's cowboy capitalism, isn't it? The student accommodation. There was a case yesterday, I think, come through the papers about a young lad who'd taken some property developer or landlord to court because he arrived at university, haven't paid 1,000 or 2,000 quid for his first semester, and the room wasn't ready. It was still a building site, and he actually took them to court and won yesterday. But it is cowboy capitalism, isn't it?
Oh well, it's there's another way of the university becoming a business. Either it itself is making money from student accommodation, or it's entering into either formal or informal partnerships with private landlords and this rentier class, as Leone said. I mean, just in Belfast, you can see on the one hand the extremes of this. We have the disaster that's the Holy Lands on the one hand, where you got slum landlords You've got students in really badly, you know, insulated, crappily, you know, heated housing and so on. And, you know, this is not to get into the antisocial elements of there, but I think it's partly that's the issue that's never really raised when it comes on to Stephen Nolan and the BBC. It's not just badly behaved students. They are actually being treated appallingly in terms of often being, you know, crammed into, you know, houses of multiple occupancy in terms of the, you know, the definition, and they're getting a crap service. And at the other end, you see that the building down in other parts of Belfast has nice, shiny, very expensive accommodation, largely for the international students. So what we have now is turbocharged this kind of property mode of creating more money through internationalization. It's now, this is a global phenomenon. It's the vampire squid, you know, now extending out to get its tentacles into every last remaining part that it can from the value chain, whether it's on food, whether it's on bars, whether it's on books, you're selling books and so on. You know, almost every element of the student experience, as it's inverted called in the marketized university, it's a way for students to ching-ching, having to shell out more and more money. And again, that's the consumption end of it. But what we've also got to connect it is the production end, which we've been talking about earlier on, that our conditions of work that Leonie and I and many of our colleagues in, that's the other element. So the whole thing is a shit show, if you look at it in you know, in the round. And certainly for those colleagues listening to this, this is a wake-up call. Many of us are slowly coming around. Some of us have been there for quite some time. But this is now, you know, a serious problem that the university is almost losing any sense of what it's originally set up to do, which is knowledge production for the good of society. That's it. That's what our job is. It has now become complicit in not just becoming a source of wealth extraction itself. We're now fucking training people to be effective wealth extractors and not even to think critically about it.
Yeah, you said it, John. Ideological state apparatuses. That's what you are. Just get with the program, man, or fuck off and get a job somewhere else, would you? Stop whining. But you're absolutely right, of course, and that's the reality. The thing is, it's not hegemony anymore. It's just ideology, because you can see it happening. It's not even disguised. It's not even kind of pretending to be other than it is, which is running this as a business and treating knowledge as a marketplace. I was reading before that private ownership of student accommodation has increased from like 18% 10 years ago to nearly 50% now. And of course, vulture funds, offshore companies thinking, well, there's a great opportunity. Let's get into that, because they have a target audience and they have an audience that doesn't have anywhere else to go. As you said, it's either into good student accommodation or into slum landlords in Belfast. And so that those are your choices. My kids are facing the same choices. My eldest is down in Galway, and she knows a lad who's living in a hostel outside Galway, who every weekend has his room, like stag do's are into his room, and he has to pack his stuff under the bed. And that's where this geezer lives whilst doing a degree, you know. The number of the students who are now commuting into university as well, taken away from that community, that university.
There are examples, Stevie, of students living in tents, living in fucking tents. That's the only way, particularly, I think it was in Cork and so on. But sorry, I know you
and
want
it's to a worry it too. The other end of this, and we might come back and have a debate. And I've got a couple of mates who are working in the students unions, who are part of the students union movement, is that the vote they had at the University of Ulster students union, the vote they had at Queen's as well, about whether to support the UCU strike or not. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, please. Nah, I understand what's going on there, I suppose, in many ways, but maybe we'll come back and have a debate about that, because solidarity goes both ways, you know. Look, I'll finish on this question here, and it's one about that. I suppose this onslaught on the institutions, the marketization of the institutions, the marketization of ideas themselves, and indeed impacts on curriculum, what's being taught and what's being researched, at a time when the public and civic role of universities has never been more important, particularly with the climate crisis. The next 20, 30 years is going to be tight, and let's put it mildly. How does the neoliberal transformation of universities affect the public civic role of universities in where you'd expect to see that challenge coming from? You'd expect to see the research coming from to say, look, we need to change tack here. No, tinkering with the system isn't the answer. We need fundamental shifts. And related to that, I suppose a related question there is there a role therefore in that, you know, for activist academics? I'll go to you first, Leonie.
Yeah, well, it profoundly undermines, doesn't it, what impacts universities can make as institutions, and what academics can do as individuals or collectively. I mean, if we think about the most powerful people in the institution, clearly they're completely wedded to a neoliberal model, in which case they can basically because they're so focused on making money in the here and now, they can never really engage. They often say they're engaging with issues of sustainability and green agendas, but these are words. They can't really, because the things they're lobbying politicians are about are things to do with student fees. Can they charge some more of them? This kind of thing. So these are top of the, you know what's top of their agenda by when you see what they speak to, in our case, Stormont about. So there's that. Then if you overwork, casualise and individualise the workforce, and don't give them any space to even have a pint together, then obviously it's much harder to engage in collective action, even intellectually, politically, in terms of your own local community and society. So there's that, and you're made to feel very small, like a minnow in a much bigger system, a sort of, you know, the inexorable kind of quality of that, of what's happening to you and that you cannot change it. So I think that's very much true. Having said that, I always think that academics completely underuse the power that they have. I think it's always instructive for academics and people working in higher education to look at other parts of the education system to think constructively about what we should be doing right now. So whilst primary and secondary education are not marketized in the same way, those teachers have been so crushed by workloads and targets and demands that and their wages have been so suppressed that is an extremely hostile working space now for people. Then we look at FE. Oh, guess what? That's where workers went to get an education, especially if they came, you know, had bad experiences with education as young people. Oh, that's had the biggest kicking of any part of our education system, FE. And University Colleges Union encompasses further education, and their fights are the most important fights, and they have had the worst working conditions, the most casualized workforce. But of course they also provide, in my view, the most radical, the most progressive education going, and are absolutely key to any revitalization of our society and any real hope for the future, to be honest. So yeah, I think we have to think about the power that we do have. We do have quite good access to the media, however tricky some elements of the media, not this element of the media, obviously, however tricky some of the mainstream media is, we have good access to it. We're still allowed to call ourselves experts. People in other parts of the education system have had that kind of sense of their own specialism and expertise stripped from them, and it was a process of pushing them down. We still hold on to that just about. And that is, those things are powerful. We can call ourselves experts. We can call upon... we can make our voice much louder via the media and other mechanisms. And if we overcome some of the things that are pushed on us by our own institutions, we can, of course, collectivise. We can, of course, work together. We have relative levels of autonomy. Unlike school teachers in a secondary school, we're not jammed in a classroom between 9 and 3:30 every day and the rest of the time swamped beyond control. We have levels of autonomy that other people don't have, and we ought to be using it right now and urgently.
Thanks very much, Leon. I'm glad you mentioned further education. My partner works in further education, and they were almost like the pilot scheme for universities, I think. I remember the Association of Northern Ireland Colleges, who we did some work with on anti-sectarian stuff 20 years ago, and their like byline was Association of Northern Ireland Colleges means business. And that was it, front and center. There you go. That was what they were heading into. John, over to you for this last one, mate. The idea of the university as a, I suppose, the civic role of universities in the climate crisis and activist academics. I mean, it's really weird, isn't it, that this managerial class and this is holding on to what can clearly be seen to be a failing system. The multiple crises of capitalism aren't going away. As someone once said, there's no capitalist way out of this crisis, is there?
And at the very time we need new imaginative, you know, a pluralistic debate around this system we currently have of capitalism, it's coming to an end. Biologically and biophysically speaking, you know, it is unsustainable. We have to move beyond it really rapidly in the next couple of decades, at the very least, to have any decent chance of our kids and grandkids, you know, having a habitable world. And I'm constantly amazed at really smart people that read the science like I do. And I kind of look at them and say, what the fuck are you doing? You know, why aren't you, like me, trying to get your nose into the media to get this debate out there, trying to get onto BBC Ulster, as I have done once or twice, to even mention capitalism? That's the driving force here, folks, of what's creating the ecocidal system that we're all now experiencing. And at the very time we need that sense of hope generated out of knowledge, knowledge which can empower people to make up decisions about how we want their societies to evolve. We're relatively mute in the academy. I think people are disciplined. They feel cowed down. They don't feel it's their right to be more political in that way. But we do need more people like me and Leonie and others who are activists, because certainly I particularly feel my section of the university, in the sense of professors, we are definitely in a privileged position. We should be the ones taking the risks. We should be the ones sticking our heads above the parapet, either within the university to challenge managerial bullshit, or certainly bringing the knowledge that we have outside to our communities and our societies to get alongside, you know, other people, and including the policy world, in the faith community, in trade unions. I particularly feel it acutely, as you would know, both of you, that I think at this time of the planetary emergency, how in the name of fuck can the university continue with business as usual? We are now complicit in the ecocidal, you know, rivet popping of the life supporting systems of the planet. And what makes it even more, you know, egregious is that we're doing it knowingly. We could be the first species, aided by a very clever academic class, where we're accurately documenting our own demise. You know, that's how serious it is. And I am beginning to see elements of people, you know, begin to see that we cannot continue with even research and teaching as usual in the context of what we're facing. To me, this is wartime mobilization. That's how serious it is. And I'm now much more comfortable both within the university and outside to be using that language, not to scaremonger, is to say that's what the fucking science is telling us. It's as simple as that. And even to use those terms, like using bad language, not to be down with the kids and be a cool professor using bad language, but that is a working class way of speaking. It's probably one of the last remaining identifiable bits of myself, even though sociologically I'd be seen as middle class in income and status. I'm still working class. You're born into a class. I'm still loyal to my class. And for me, that's what motivates me, because it's the working class who have most to lose if we don't address the planetary emergency. And basically, universities need to turn up, academics need to stand up and stand out at this time of crisis and great opportunity to fix so many things in our society.
Thanks for that, John. Thanks for that message. I hope there. You mentioned we're the first generation to record our own demise. You saw that Earth black box thing, didn't you, in Tasmania? A marketing company has built a black box for the planet, which is going to record our the great unraveling, as we're going to call the rest of this century, unless we reverse quickly. Thanks very much, folks, for that. I really enjoyed it. Could have gone on, but we'll keep it. We've gone over time anyway, but I hope people enjoy listening to that. We can meet again, of course. There's lots to talk about. And thanks very much, and we'll see you again.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade.
Thanks, Stevie.
Up the workers and Slangle Foyle.